listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the psychological roadblocks people have when it comes to understanding the massive numbers of COVID-related deaths and illnesses. Now, congressional leaders say they're in the final stages of agreeing to a deal for another COVID-19 economic relief package. Some items likely to be in the $900-plus billion legislation that's anticipated include enhanced federal unemployment benefits of $300 per week, more money for the Paycheck Protection Program, and potentially direct stimulus checks of around $600. Lawmakers have negotiated the relief bill on and off for months now, and they're running up against their holiday break. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said earlier today he's feeling optimistic.
So I'm encouraged that our Democratic colleagues have now embraced this framework. That's been the right solution for our country all this time. And a bipartisan, bicameral agreement appears to be close at hand.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress pass another economic relief bill? What kind of assistance would help you or your family most right now? In particular, what do you think of the idea of extending enhanced unemployment benefits? And what do you think of the idea of another direct stimulus check going to many people, maybe with an income requirement on that? What financial challenges have you faced during the pandemic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ioana Marinescu is an assistant professor of public policy at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice. She's also a faculty research fellow for the National Bureau of Economic Research. Ioana, welcome to Central Time.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, looking at the state of the economy right now toward the end of this pandemic year, first of all, do you see a need for something, some kind of package from Congress to give the economy a boost right now?
Absolutely. We really need stimulus now, and it's really urgent, and they shouldn't go home before they pass one because the economy right now is in very precarious situation. The unemployment rate has started going up again. So both from the point of view of people who are experiencing this, while at the same time the death count is mounting, as well as for businesses, this round of stimulus is urgent and necessary.
Staying with the big picture, we're hearing numbers of a little over $900 billion. Sounds like a big number. Is it enough to make a difference?
I think it's definitely useful and probably not enough. However, at this point, it's more important to get money into the economy sooner rather than try to get a bigger deal that isn't going to have bipartisan support. So I think it's probably not enough, but getting this now is essential and will make a difference.
And let's look at some of the particular ideas here. It looked like it wasn't going to be in there at some point, the idea of a direct stimulus payment to most Americans. Now it looks like there'll be something there. What do you think of that as a policy? Is this something that's effective, first of all, for the economy as a whole, just giving lots of people money, not necessarily based on need?
Right. So, you know, you have to remember that this money, first of all, there is a cap on income. And second of all, it's going to be repaid disproportionately by higher income people through our tax system. So that's first. But this kind of system, relative to other more targeted systems, allows everybody to get something so that nobody falls through the cracks, because not everybody qualifies for, say, unemployment insurance. And so this is some kind of money that everybody can get without having to, you know, jump through hoops to show qualification. So therefore, the big advantage is that it leaves nobody behind. And then it allows these people to spend money on, you know, groceries and, you know, their daily needs. And this is the sort of thing that props up local businesses who very much need the money right now, as many of them have been hammered during the pandemic.
Let's talk about those local businesses. And we know particular kinds of businesses, restaurants, bars, entertainment venues, arts places, things like that, places where people gather indoors are the hardest hit, they and their employees. Do you see things in the package as it currently stands that is going to help those hardest hit businesses where they need it?
Right. So some of the package is help towards businesses, and help is needed because we want to avoid a major wave of bankruptcy. that could happen through additional business closures. Already, a lot of these businesses, in entertainment, bars and restaurants have had to close. And having even more closures, unfortunately, has a snowball effect in the economy and can deepen the recession. So from the point of view of managing the current situation, it's extremely important to provide some help to these businesses to smooth things out. And hopefully, once the vaccine is underway, some of these will be able to reopen, survive, and even thrive.
Now, with the stimulus payments, as you mentioned, we'll spend money, we'll hopefully help businesses. But if there are people out there who are thinking, I don't want to go into a restaurant right now because I'm worried about COVID, a $300 check or a $600 check or whatever isn't going to persuade them. Is that kind of money not going to help the businesses that need it the most?
So that's a great point. It's not going to necessarily help some of these businesses like restaurants a great deal, although a lot of them are doing deliveries at home. So that market is booming, and the stimulus checks helps a lot. So if you look at the companies who do online deliveries, when the stimulus was, given to people, they had huge increases in orders. So that is a way, certainly for restaurants, to make money, and it really matters, and people spend money that way. But it's true that, for example, for entertainment venues, it's not really going to help. And so that's why this giving money to people is not enough. And we also need some of the business side of helping businesses get through this. But the money to the people will help an array of other types of businesses like retail, groceries, things like that. And people have been spending a lot more on goods, buying stuff for their homes and, stuff they need. And that still helps the economy, props up these businesses, and allows them to either maintain or even sometimes create jobs. Like, for example, there's been a lot of job creation in warehousing because people order online a lot.
We're talking to Ioana Marinescu from the University of Pennsylvania, looking at a stimulus package, an economic relief package being negotiated in Congress this time. A lot of people are saying something will actually happen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see something get passed over the next couple of days? What should be in it, do you think? What would make a difference for you? What do you worry about ending up in there? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Now, it looks like this will see a return, Ioana, of enhanced unemployment benefits for people for a period of time. It looks like $300 weekly. What do you think of that? How important is that?
So I think that's very helpful because in the past, in the CARES Act, they had $600 weekly. And it turns out that my colleague Eliza Forsythe has shown that the extra unemployment benefits were instrumental in preventing people from losing income. So that, without the extra unemployment benefits, there would be a huge drop in income, especially among workers who are already low paid. So that would have, make the inequality really explode in terms of who is affected by this. So therefore, I think it's quite important to reinstate it, and it will prevent some of the biggest, glaring inequalities, again, due to the fact that a lot of the workers who lost their jobs were already not making a lot of income and have trouble making ends meet. And as we just said before, a lot of these businesses either aren't open or are operating below capacity. So these people find it very difficult to find a new job right now. So therefore, it makes a lot of sense to, pay them some extra income so that they can maintain their spending, which, again, remember, also helps businesses.
There have been arguments from some Republicans in Congress over the course of all this, including Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson saying, hold on, if you set unemployment benefits too high, it disincentivizes people from looking for work and maybe moving from that restaurant job to that warehouse job that you mentioned. Is that a concern?
Right. So in general, we know from economic research that, and research I've done myself, that indeed higher benefits can discourage job search. So, the number of applications that people send in particular. However, what's important to note in the present moment is that there are so many unemployed and so few jobs that even if each person reduces the number of applications a little bit, the unemployed collectively are sending so many applications that on average, businesses still have plenty of candidates to go by. And so therefore, there is no effect necessarily on employment. And that has been shown for the CARES Act, both from my own research and the colleagues' research, even though $600 was more than people could make for many of them while working. still it didn't result in greater unemployment. Again, the reason being that there's just not enough jobs out there. And even if people apply a little bit less, collectively, there's so many unemployed people that jobs are still getting flooded with resumes. So really, it's critical to understand that even if it creates a mild disincentive to look for jobs, when there's not enough jobs, each job can still receive plenty of applicants because there's just so many unemployed out there. So right now, the key problem, in other terms, another way of putting it, the key problem in the economy today is not that people aren't searching enough. The key problem we're dealing with is that there's not enough jobs. And so really, the stimulus will also be helping with that, as we were mentioning earlier, by allowing people to keep buying things and therefore businesses to have customers.
We're talking to Ioana Marinescu, labor economist and professor of public policy at the University of Pennsylvania, looking at what's likely to be in a COVID-19 relief package being negotiated in Congress and how effective it would be for people, for businesses, and for the economy as a whole. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress pass a relief bill before the holidays? What should be part of it? Do you want to see these stimulus payments going to most Americans, maybe with some kind of income requirement? Do you want unemployment benefits to be enhanced for a longer period of time? What would help you, your business, your workplace? Call 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ioana Marinescu, economist at the University of Pennsylvania, looking at the latest on the economic relief bill being negotiated in Congress. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Heather is with us in Marquesan. Heather, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just think this whole government stimulus package isn't a good idea. I think that people just need to be able to go back to work. People want to work, and there shouldn't even be a job shortage, but there is because the government has made everybody dependent on them, and the media has scared everybody so much over this COVID, saying, "Oh, if you go out or go with your have family gatherings, you're all going to get COVID and people are going to die, and now you're pushing this vaccine on people." Just listen to the people and let them get back to work, and then there wouldn't be a job shortage. People wouldn't have to go on in unemployment. People
gotcha,
wouldn't have.
Heather, thanks a lot for calling in. You want to end COVID restrictions, let people go back to work, and Heather says the economy will bounce back.
So, you know, I mean, I think that what's right about that is that COVID is the main reason why we are in this terrible situation. And even without restrictions, people don't want to go out there. And that's how we lost a lot of jobs. So really, fundamentally, the problem is COVID. But I don't think it's the media making a big deal out of it. The reality is 300,000 Americans have died. So really, the big problem that's causing all this job loss is COVID, and we got to address that, and hopefully, you know, and we know vaccines are coming, but it's still going to take a while. So in the meantime, we need the stimulus to bridge that gap.
And I've heard for months now, Ioana, a lot of economists from different perspectives saying, yeah, we're really not going to be able to solve the economy until we solve COVID. Is that still fair to say?
I think that's still fair to say, and that's really the fundamental roadblock to economic recovery is COVID. And then, unfortunately, it's still going to take a while, most likely, before we recover. But without getting COVID under control, it's just not working.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Marcus now in Madison. Marcus, hello.
Good afternoon. Two quick points for you, Professor Marinescu. Number one, for example, your point about there aren't enough jobs is certainly true. To put a finer point on it, there's a shortage of decent jobs. Half the workers in Wisconsin make less than $15 an hour. And number two, the original CARES Act is not a stimulus, as is this bill in economic terms, as I understand it. This is at best a mitigation. As far as I am able to discern, we made up about a third of what we lost before the pandemic, and there are still a million unemployment filings a week. The numbers you hear on media are counting full-time workers only. So if you add them all in, it's still a million filing for unemployment every week. Could you please address these two things? This is an austerity measure, in my opinion.
Marcus, thanks for the call. So first of all, Marcus's read on the unemployment figures, I don't know how do you sort that out, Ioana?
Right. So it's true that unemployment, new filings for unemployment have been going up again, and it's in the 800,000, so indeed almost a million. So this just shows that the economy is still in dire straits. So, but the thing is, unfortunately, when there's a recession, and we have learned over time, the government has learned to take actions that will mitigate the recession. But typically, we cannot avoid it entirely. And this has been a particularly bad hit in terms of the initial shock was faster than anything we've seen in recent history. And that also goes to our earlier point that I was saying that this stimulus is probably not enough. But if it weren't for this stimulus, the situation would be even worse in terms of both poverty and how people are affected, as well as in terms of the businesses and them not being able to have customers, or for those who are closed, being able to get some sort of financial support to make it through. So that points, the fact that we're still in a bad situation just points to the fact that we need vigorous government action, and that the action we've had is perhaps not enough, but it doesn't show that the action we have had wasn't useful type of action, and we should definitely, you know, take action with the new round of stimulus.
Thanks for the call, Marcus. Ken joins us next in Blanchardville. Ken, hi.
Hey, well, thanks for taking my call. I was kind of fired up by your last caller who was just saying that people want to work, but they're dependent on the government and that they should just go back to work and forget about the COVID and the fear and all that, which is absurd non-recognition that 310,000 people have already died from this thing. My wife would love to go back to work. She actually, her boss, who's a friend of ours, but is a Trumper, and we're not, and yet we remain friends. But it's a ridiculous assumption, a right-wing talking point, and kind of a troll call, in my opinion, that she would put this out there. We would love to go back to work, and we would prefer not to get a government check or government cheese, you know. We'd rather be working, and we have the pride in doing that. So anyway, it just kind of fired me up that she just was in denial and probably will not take the vaccine if it's offered to her. And,
gotcha. Ken, thanks a lot for calling in. Ioana, most people, Ken is saying, and his family certainly would rather be working than taking unemployment, maybe even regardless of the number comparison between what you get paid on the job or off.
That's right. And that's why, you know, we have seen some decrease in applications, probably due to the CARES Act, but it wasn't spectacular at all, considering that people were getting paid more for being unemployed than on the job. And then the other thing I want to tell our listeners is that if you look across countries, the countries that have been the best at limiting the rise in cases and deaths of COVID were also the best in terms of limiting the decline in the economy and the GDP. So that really goes back to our earlier point that the key issue we're facing here is the virus, and that creates a major economic fallout.
Thanks a lot for that call. Ioana, I wanted to ask, from the outset, I've seen some people making the case that, okay, if we know that, you know, restaurants and event halls and bars and things like that are likely places to spread the disease, why not, you know, close them down, but then totally compensate them for their lost business? Like, pay them to do this service for the country, in effect, has been the argument. I think some European countries have taken that approach. Was there a case to be made for that? Is that still something that I don't think it's really on the table? Is that something that would have been a viable option?
Right. So in Europe, the typical approach was to essentially pay businesses and people not to work, basically to freeze the economy. Let's keep the things how they are. Support the people, support the businesses, but while the people stay employed, right? So everything stays as if we were still going, and then we hope to reopen later. In the U.S., there's been relatively less help for businesses and more help for the unemployed. So the unemployment rate in the U.S. increased a lot more than it has increased in Europe. And I think, you know, in that sense, there's a difference in the strategy, and only the longer run will tell which was better, because the European strategy is certainly better in the short run because it averts a huge increase in unemployment. But in the longer run, you know, how long can you hold it and possibly the economy has to readjust a little bit. So it's kind of partly about how do we get from there to the new future. And now we're getting closer, but this whole crisis, you know, has been already, unfortunately, lasting a long time. So I think it's only after the fact that we'll be able to tell, you know, what pros and cons there were to either strategy, again, which would be either kind of freeze the businesses, keep them in place, pay them to continue existing without operating, or just kind of allow them, some of them, to just close, and then the people would be unemployed and will give some money to the unemployed. So again, there's pros and cons to each of the approaches, and only once we do a study after the fact, we'll get a better perspective on what those pros and cons were.
In our last minute, Ioana, we're watching hour by hour, really, to see what's going to happen in Congress. Are you optimistic that at least something that will come along, maybe it's not a stimulus, maybe it's a mitigation, but that something is going to come out of this over the weekend?
Absolutely. It seems highly likely at this point that something is going to come out. I think they've been negotiated for months, and I think...
think we just lost our guest, but we were just about done anyway. Ioana Marinescu was with us, assistant professor of public policy at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Social Policy and Practice, fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. She talked with us about the latest COVID-19 relief bill in Congress and what kind of support could make the most difference for people in need. You can keep sharing your thoughts, by the way. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR. Coming up, with more than 300,000 deaths resulting from COVID-19 in the U.S., it's a staggering number, but it can be hard to wrap our minds around a number like that and to translate it into safer behavior. A decision psychologist joins the show for a look at the best ways to communicate that kind of information and the best ways to understand it and take action in our own lives, whether we're talking about a pandemic or other kinds of risk in our lives. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The COVID pandemic has claimed the lives of more than 4,000 people in Wisconsin. This week, as we approach the end of the year, WPR is profiling some of the people we lost here in the state. Today, Bram Sable-Smith tells us about Dwayne Bark, who died in October.
Dwayne Bark was nearly late for his wedding. He went out golfing that morning with the minister, and they left the course later than intended. When Pam, the bride-to-be, showed up at the church to drop off her dress, the door was locked because the minister had the key.
And I'll never forget when I was beating at the door, they were whisking around to open the church up so I could get in because even the minister was running late. So we laugh about that.
There were many laughs over the next 38 years. Dwayne was a joker with a knack for cutting tension, a useful skill for an educator and football coach, two of the great passions of Dwayne's life. As his mom, Jill Bark, remembers, their roots go back to the day he entered the world.
His very, very, very first gift when he was born was a football.
It was a gift from a family friend who misspelled Dwayne's name on the ball and had to run to the store to buy shoe polish to add an E. Dwayne continued that tradition when his own children were born, but with better spelling. His sons Bradley and Brian each got a football, and daughter Brittany got a volleyball. Football practices were a family affair for all of the Bark children, even before they were old enough to suit up themselves. Brian, the middle child, was always the water boy. One time he was picking up water bottles at practice when the whistle blew, and a stampede of high schoolers ran him over.
I remember realizing all of a sudden I was in my dad's hands, and he was just looking down at me saying, "Brian, this will be all right. You're not hurt. You're going to be fine."
Brian says that's the kind of guy his dad was for everybody, always there to pick you up when you needed it most. By the time the pandemic hit, Dwayne was the superintendent in Marquesan, leading that community through these unprecedented and scary times. He recorded this video message for the families of the students.
If you have a need, please reach out to us, even if it's a personal need. If you have a situation that you need to talk to somebody or you need something, please, please call us.
Dwayne caught COVID this summer from a family friend who tested negative before coming over for a visit. Everyone in the house got sick, Dwayne, Brittany, Pam, and Pam's mother. Dwayne went to the hospital on July 23rd, his 61st birthday. By August, he was placed in a medically induced coma and hooked up to a ventilator. Bradley, the oldest son, says it was surreal.
This is our hero. This is our mentor. This is our coach. This is our dad that is laying in there with a tube down his throat just to help him breathe.
Dwayne fought for months, but by October, it was clear he was dying. His family gathered around his hospital bed one last time. Bradley read Bible verses of comfort. When he finished the Lord's Prayer,
Dad opened up his eyes, wide as could be, looking up at the ceiling of the hospital room, looking up at the ceiling, tears coming out of his eyes, and he flatlined at that point.
2 months later, Dwayne's father, Doug, also died from COVID. It's been a trying time for the Bark family. Pam says some days it still feels like she's waiting for Dwayne to come back home.
My mind tells me, with my faith, I know where he's at. You know, I know he's in heaven. My heart just hasn't caught up to it yet.
Dwayne Bark was nearly late for his wedding because he was golfing with the minister. 38 years later, it still gets a laugh. But it was also an omen for the life Dwayne built. A life full of sports, faith, and family. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, WPR will bring you the story of a Milwaukee man who overcame his own struggles and became a champion for veterans. Now, when we hear about deaths from COVID-19 in news reports, we get the latest numbers often and sometimes comparisons so we can better visualize the scope of what we're talking about.
This vaccine news comes alongside a dramatic increase in the number of deaths. We're now around 300,000 people dead in the United States alone. I'm troubled to even say this next sentence, but someone has put it on the page in front of me. 300,000 dead is like wiping out the city of Pittsburgh.
Mm.
And we're not done. How much worse could it get?
You know, this upward trend in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths that began.
That was NPR's Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep talking to health reporter Allison Aubrey earlier this week. How we talk about the numbers can have an impact on how we process them, and so can the daily grind of hearing about the rising number of people dying from the disease. How does this all factor into people's decision-making about whether to engage in safe or unsafe practices going forward? You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of when you hear the latest numbers when it comes to COVID around the state and around the country? Do you worry that people get numb to it at this point? How does seeing the numbers make you feel? Do you think it's effective how this information gets communicated? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ellen Peters is a decision psychologist and the Philip H. Knight Chair and Director of the Center for Science Communication Research at the University of Oregon. Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, what is your basic answer to the question of how do we convey these massive numbers that have stories behind them without making it everyday people get lost in them as statistics?
Yeah, so it's actually a really tough thing to do because our brains are not wired to make sense of these kind of big numbers. There's sort of two different ways that we understand numbers. One is kind of with our thinking minds, and these big numbers overwhelm our thinking minds. We tend to be what we call innumerate when it comes to, you know, lacking in numeric literacy when it comes to these big numbers. But they're also beyond the capacity of our intuitive minds. And so they're really tough things to do. So when you're communicating numbers, there are a variety of things that you can do. You can try to do those comparisons, whether it's to the number of people who died at Pearl Harbor or the number of the entire population of Pittsburgh. So you can go ahead and do that descriptively. You can also show graphics. You can show visual depictions, trying to help people get a sense of how large that number is when it's kind of beyond them. But then the other thing that you can do is also you can try to put the tears back on the statistics, which is kind of what you were just trying to do, Rob, when you were telling the story of Dwayne Burke and his father.
One of the goals here is probably to, whatever the situation, in this case the pandemic, is to have people hear this information, see this information, and then act on it. In this case, you know, wearing the mask when they're around people, socially distancing, not traveling, that kind of thing. For most people in the country, I think that is working, but not for everybody. How do you take this information and use it to translate into positive action?
Yeah, so you do want to present numbers in ways that people can understand, which is what I was kind of touching on a minute ago. But there's other stuff you have to do, too. So communicators, whether it's the incoming Biden administration or people in your or communicators in your own city, need to be sending out messages to people from trusted sources, because communications that come from people we trust are more persuasive. People are more likely to do what's asked or recommended when the message comes from somebody, when it comes from someone they trust. There are other things we need to do, too, though. We also have to figure out how to establish and maintain what are called social norms about following guidelines. We want to get the grand bulk of people getting vaccinated, wearing masks, socially distancing. And then we want to communicate what those social norms actually exist, because they can guide and direct behaviors. People conform to and do what other people are also doing. And so that's another sort of evidence-based communication technique that can be used. Other things are telling stories. That's, again, that goes back to your, the story of Dwayne Burke. And I suspect you've had lots of other stories, unfortunately, in your city and state to talk about, where again, you're kind of trying to put the tears back on the statistics. There's a variety of different things that you can do to get people to pay more attention to the importance of taking protective behaviors. Another thing is to focus on what people value. And oftentimes what we value is not just doing stuff for ourselves, but doing stuff for other people as well. And so, telling people, and I've told people this many times, I wear a mask because I don't want to accidentally infect somebody who's in a really vulnerable population. And so getting people to think about not just what their behavior does for themselves, but connecting it with other people that they care about. I had a student at one point, and I was actually surprised by this. He ended up testing positive for COVID, and he got really, really upset. And he wasn't upset because he was sick. He was upset because he had gone to his barber right after getting sick, and he was worried he might have infected him. And it made him feel terrible because he didn't want to infect somebody who he really cared about.
In the media, sometimes we focus on, well, with COVID, with the people pushing back on some of the guidelines, masks and things like that, even though they tend to be, according to surveys anyway, a small portion of the population, instead of focusing in the media on the fact that most people are observing these guidelines. Does that send a message to somebody watching about what's really happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So that connects directly back with the idea of social norms. Anytime we're communicating and trying to get people to do something, if most people are doing it, we want you to know that most people are doing it. If you focus on the few people who aren't, I remember early on in the pandemic, they were showing, the crowded beaches down in Florida. But most people actually were socially distancing and being responsible. And that's what you want to communicate. You want to communicate that the great bulk of people are doing what it takes to keep all of us safe, because we're going to conform to that. We're going to do what other people do. It's going to tell us, yeah, that's right. That is the right thing to do. And they can do it. And I can do that, too.
We're talking with decision psychologist Ellen Peters from the University of Oregon about how people are or are not processing the information that's out there about COVID deaths and cases. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has your response to hearing about COVID numbers, COVID deaths changed over time? Was there a moment that you remember this year where a switch was flipped and you realized, this is a big deal, and it's going to affect our lives? What was that moment? What was that thing that changed your mind? Do you feel a fatigue as you see the numbers every day? Do you see other people thinking, giving up on following what's going on and just living their lives. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our conversation about how and whether we people can wrap our minds around the number of COVID deaths and cases being reported and how best to communicate information like that. Our guest is decision psychologist Ellen Peters from the University of Oregon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think back on your emotions since March when things around the country largely locked down as this thing, it was clear this was serious? What changed your behavior? If there's something that did at a certain point where you thought, wow, I guess I should wear a mask, make a mask for others to wear. What changed your behavior if you are involved in communicating risk about disease or anything? Love to hear how you try to accomplish that. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ellen, is there something uniquely challenging about a disease, especially a disease like COVID that, you know, has this lag time between when it hits a community and when the numbers start showing up, and that a lot of times is in a different place and it's kind of invisible. And the people suffering for it, they're not doing it in plain sight. They're in a hospital somewhere.
Yeah, it's actually a really tough situation. It's tough because the disease is really abstract to a lot of people. A lot of people don't actually know anybody who've had it or who have had a bad case of it in any event. And so you end up with this situation where, one, the actual likelihood of infection is relatively low, but when it does occur, it spreads like wildfire. But it spreads like wildfire like 3, 4, 5 days later, and in kind of an unknown way, because sometimes most of the time, if you get sick from somebody, it doesn't look like they're sick, and as a result, you know, what you're responding to is just the possibility of getting sick. Not that there's someone in front of you coughing, but that someone around you might be infected, and they might be a super spreader, for example, and you could get it. And so you just simply need to protect yourself all the time without having any kind of sort of vivid demonstration of the disease that you can react to and say, oh yeah, that's right, I need to be doing this. I need to be staying safe and keeping other people around me safe.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jason is with us in Plover. Jason, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to say you were asking for, like, you know, the moment that, you know, people really became alarmed. And for me, it was when the NCAA canceled the March Madness tournament, because my brother went to Michigan State University, and he knows how much revenue the big sports bring into universities these days. And so when the NCAA was willing to part with all of that money that they make off the March Madness tournament, that's when I got concerned. I was like, wow, this is real. This is something to worry about.
So. Jason, thank you so much for sharing that. I had a similar thing. You know, I'd been talking about this on the air since late January, but the moment it really hit me was when the NBA, it was another basketball story, when they decided we're going to leave a lot of money on the table and shut down. Ellen, seeing a big institution like that take this really seriously, take what might appear a drastic step, is that something that helps communicate to people like me and Jason?
Yeah, it totally does. So that kind of thing is such a surprise where it just makes you stop and think, like, oh my gosh, what is it that's really going on here? And I think that's what happened to Jason, and I think that's probably what happened to you. You suddenly realize this is much bigger than I was counting on originally.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jason. We'll go to Laura now in New Berlin. Laura, hello.
Hi. I was saying that the turning point for me was when my daughter, who's a nurse and was working in a COVID ICU, called to inform me that she has a DNR put in place and that she's told that if she gets this, that they are not allowed to intubate her. And she said, I'm telling you because they will try to call you to, you know, change your mind, to get me to change my mind. And she was very upset because she just had a 35-year-old patient die. This was in early April. She had a 35-year-old patient with no pre-existing issues pass, you know, die from COVID.
Wow. Laura, thank you for sharing that. DNR, do not resuscitate order. The messages we've heard, Ellen, from those critical care workers, emergency room workers and others, how powerful can that be in communicating the seriousness of a situation like this?
They can be incredibly powerful. And first, Laura, thank your daughter from all of us. Her job's incredible. Those kind of concrete, vivid, easy to imagine experiences, they convey in ways that little else can. Numbers can't convey it. Numbers are so abstract. And, you know, just hearing 300,000 people died or 290,000 people died, it's like it doesn't even sort of get past the filters in our brain to say that it's important. But you hear about someone like Laura's daughter and the experience that she heard and the fact that she herself is not willing to be resuscitated having watched that. And it just grabs you by the heartstrings. And those kind of emotional reactions are much of what drives our real reactions to risk. We rely on those kind of emotional reactions to tell us, what is it that's really dangerous out there for me and what should I do about it?
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Ellen Peters from the University of Oregon. She is a decision psychologist. We're talking about how best to communicate information about a serious threat, in this case, mainly our current pandemic. Brian joins us next in Sharon. Brian, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Brian?
Yes. I've been following on the conversation tonight, and I just wanted to kind of make a mention of what your question was. When did I first notice when the pandemic was serious? In my line of work, I'm actually a steel technician for a property maintenance company. And when the lockdown in Wisconsin occurred, it really struck me that very day that it almost seemed like apocalyptic, where the roads, which are normally quite busy in my daily routine, were empty. And my company that I work for, I go into residences all the time. And again, as I noticed that first day being out on the road where nobody was around, I really thought to myself, okay, PPE is going to be very, very important at this point moving forward. And thankfully, by the luck of just being, following the science and being very careful what I do every day in my daily routine, thankfully, I have maintained not getting infected at this point.
Brian, thank you so much. That rings a bell, I'm sure, for a lot of people. I remember walking in my neighborhood and that eerie silence. But Ellen, maybe that did, apart from the effect of the lockdown itself, that may have been a way to convey information about the seriousness of the situation.
Yeah, absolutely, Rob. Excuse me. What that kind of a cue is saying is that something's wrong and something is seriously wrong because those roads shouldn't be empty. I remember that exact same experience where I live and just being so surprised at how eerie it was that there was no one out on the road and having, that little bit of like, oh my gosh, I should be afraid of this kind of experience. And so it gives you that kind of cue to experience an emotion that, again, you can use as information as you go forward about how risky this thing is. But it also goes back to what you were saying before, Rob, where you talked about this idea that, it gives you a cue about what others are doing. And what others are doing is they're not going outside. They're not mixing and mingling. They're staying home and they're staying safe.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute, I worry, Ellen, early on in COVID, I thought, well, there was Ebola and we were worried about that. It didn't end up being a thing here. It's happened other times with diseases. And I, just in my own job in broadcasting, I don't want to err on the side of over scaring people. Just can you take a few moments to talk about how we balance that?
Yeah. So, we do use our, a lot of research tells us that we use our emotions to figure out what we, what we should be what we should be afraid of, what we should be avoiding. So, you feel fear, for example, when you walk down a dark alley and it's telling you, you need to be aware here. You need to be looking around, making sure you're safe. Maybe you shouldn't be in that dark alley at all. And so those kind of gut feelings are usually helpful. They sort of act as a GPS for us to help us figure out, well, which way should I go? But those gut feelings aren't always helpful. They can sometimes overwhelm us into panic. It can also mess with the filters we normally have for what's real news and what's fake news. But what ends up happening is this kind of a situation that's going on and on and on, you know, we've been on a global lockdown since mid-March, basically. We're not equipped to feel worse and worse and worse every day. Instead, what we tend to do is we adapt and we kind of numb ourselves to these kinds of ongoing stressors. And it's just so that we can be functional and go on with our lives. But people are really adaptive. There's even a theory, it's called opponent process theory. And what it says is that when you experience an emotion, like a negative emotion that a lot of your callers have been talking about, you experience that negative emotion, but then you more or less automatically experience a positive one. And so you can think about like roller coasters. They're really scary at first and that's unpleasant. But over time, the opposing emotion kicks in and it becomes kind of fun and you remember it as enjoyable.
We'll have to leave it there, but we can talk about this more again. Thanks to Ellen Peters from the University of Oregon, talking today about how we communicate risk in a serious situation like a pandemic. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. We'll take a look at the new car market and what else is coming down the pike in 2021. Ferret, this is Central Time.